The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. If you have followed any of the mainstream consumer and tech media, it is impossible not to have come across articles and opinion pieces about ChatGPT. Launched as a prototype in November of 2022, ChatGPT is an AI-powered natural language processing tool that allows eerily human-like conversations. Students, everyday consumers, and business workers have flocked to OpenAI's site to try it out. Chances are you have too. A recent survey from professional networking app Fishbowl found that 43% of working professionals have used AI tools such as ChatGPT to accomplish tasks at work. Of those, 68% had not admitted this use to their boss. For many, ChatGPT has been the first tangible experience with the awesome potential of AI. ChatGPT has highlighted the excitement and fear about the potential consequences of AI for humanity, and in doing so has pushed forth the need to examine if and how to regulate AI. In early April of this year, Italy became the first country to openly ban ChatGPT over privacy concerns. A few weeks before, on March 22nd, a not-for-profit called Future of Life Institute penned an open letter cautioning that AI, with, quote, human competitive intelligence, unquote, could become a major threat to humanity and called for a six-month moratorium on the development of systems more powerful than that of GPT-4, the latest iteration of ChatGPT. The petition claimed to have more than 1,800 signatories, including Elon Musk, the cognitive scientist Gary Marcus, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Although the petition sparked controversy as some of the signatories were revealed to be fake, the fact remains that many experts are troubled by the lack of guardrails in the development of AI. In other words, we currently lack a coherent and global roadmap on how we should address issues such as fairness, transparency, standards, and innovation. It is hard to impossible to impose borders on technology, especially transformational ones such as AI. So it stands to reason that like-minded governments such as US, UK, and EU should find ways to cooperate on AI innovation and regulation. That cooperation should be based on an approach that promotes shared values such as respect for human rights, inclusion, non-discrimination, and protection of privacy and personal data. However, this is easier said than done. The U.S. is far behind the EU in regulating AI. Not only that, the U.S. government has thus far taken an agency-by-agency approach. For example, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau maintains that the Equal Credit Opportunity Act requires companies to offer a simple explanation if they deny credit access, even if the denial was issued by an AI system. The Department of Health and Human Services, on the other hand, has a number of efforts underway to combat racial bias in healthcare arising from healthcare provisioning algorithms. There is, however, little to no action from federal agencies on addressing AI surveillance, despite federal law enforcement's extensive use and reliance on it. Regardless of where you stand on AI, there are at least three broad areas that require thoughtful introspection and hopefully collaboration beyond our borders: standardization, oversight and a regulation, and innovation. The question is how.
Alex Engler is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he studies implications of artificial intelligence and emerging technologies on society and governance. He also teaches AI policy as an adjunct professor in the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. He is a winner of the Fulbright Schumann Innovation Award, which took him to Berlin and Brussels to study EU digital governance. Previously, Alex was a faculty member at the University of Chicago, teaching classes on large-scale data science to policy students, and ran UChicago's Master of Science program in computational analysis and public policy. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So you are a co-author on a paper called The Importance and Opportunities of Transatlantic Cooperation on AI. Why should we look to collaborate with our allies on AI, and what are the key areas for transatlantic cooperation with regard to AI?
Sure. There's a bunch of different parts about this. One is fairly straightforward. It's just the normal trade argument. If you start building AI systems into basically everything, that includes cars and boats and pieces of safety equipment and manufacturing materials, as well as software, and more commonly, maybe we think about platforms that cross international borders like Facebook and LinkedIn. It becomes a really complicated and almost universal trade issue if we have different sets of protections and different rules in all sorts of different geographies and different countries. That's the most obvious reason, but there's other benefits too. If you have shared oversight, then federal agencies and oversight agencies in different countries can work together, and you're more likely to find fraud and abuse. It means you can point research in the same direction. If researchers create better open source tools for explainability and for transparency or for non-discrimination that meet these laws, well, they're useful for everyone and not just the place that they're invented. So those are kind of the things we know about now. It's worth noting that a lot of these issues are still pretty new and we're not entirely sure, but it seems like a good idea to have some collaboration internationally on this sort of emerging field of AI governance.
Absolutely. And what would you say is the current state of coordination or collaboration in the areas of innovation, regulation, and standards?
There is some good news on that front. The big development, at least from our perspective here in the US, would be the US-EU-TTC. That's the Trade and Technology Council. And it's really oriented towards a broader set of problems than just AI. In fact, AI isn't one of the working groups. It was sort of almost an appendix, almost like an addition at the end. And yet it's seen some of the most meaningful developments. This is especially true with a new project to sort of measure and evaluate the progress of AI jointly, in which the EU and the US agreed to catalog a lot of tools and metrics about how we evaluate what's going on in the field, evaluate how we might test AI systems in ways that we can agree. So even if we don't yet have the rules written of what it means for an algorithm to be accurate, it's good that we're all using the same language and using the same set of tools to agree on what the word accuracy could even mean and how you might test that. That's about the stage we are in this sort of US-EU relationship, which is to say pretty early on. That being said, it's a lot more coordination than there was, say, 2 years ago.
Now, congratulations, by the way, on the paper you just published with the Brookings Institution. That paper is titled "The EU and US Diverge on AI Regulation, a Transatlantic Comparison and Steps to Alignment." As I mentioned in the initial part, there is still a difference in how the US and EU are managing setting guardrails for AI. For example, as I mentioned, the US has an agency-by-agency approach that seems somewhat patchwork, whereas the EU has this risk-based approach that says, okay, the law categorizes the uses based on the types of risks that it poses. So in this paper, you talk about some of the challenges. Can you talk a little bit about what those challenges are and really how do we come to this alignment? What are the key things we need to do to come to alignment?
Yeah, and I thought your description at the beginning was quite good, but it maybe is even a little bit harder than how we're describing it now. On some areas of AI, the EU is passing a new law and creating new standards across the board. Most commonly, you can think of the EU AI Act. And in the US, rather than doing anything comprehensive, we're adapting individual agencies incrementally. But that only works at all in a strategy where you already have existing law. So in the areas where the US doesn't have existing law, we're doing nothing at all, or very little, maybe a little more fair. But that includes things like social networks, for which we have no legal regime. So the algorithms that power them, recommender systems, nothing. We're not really having any, you know, serious, meaningful intervention there at all. It's also true of e-commerce sites that drive product recommendations, for instance, on Amazon. Again, in the EU, you have your own pieces of legislation for this, the Digital Markets Act for online markets, the Digital Services Act for online social media platforms and search engines and other things like that. And so in some senses, the US can adapt law to sort of emerging uses of AI. And in others, we just don't yet have a legal regime. So it's really hard to say oh, we'll just adapt what we have now. Well, there isn't enough to even do that. That's going to leave a pretty big distinction, even with early efforts to agree on terms and metrics like we're trying to do through the TTC. Probably something that'll need to be picked up by Congress eventually.
So I think a lot of this is started, at least, by focusing on things like the recommender algorithms or the hiring aid systems that have been built to do profiling or sort of narrowing down focus on candidates, and those are typically behind the scenes. Alexa mentioned ChatGPT is sort of the world's first personal exposure to the power of computational systems, if you will. But is that a different beast in some regards? Is the fact that, for instance, ChatGPT can impersonate a human being a little bit different than decisions being made behind your back? And are there implications for regulation?
Yeah, definitely. And it's an important point because the idea that algorithmic systems are new in our experience just isn't true. You can think of financial services where underwriting models that decide things like interest rates and who gets a mortgage and who doesn't, those have been algorithmically generated for decades, probably as much as 30 or 40 years. And that's just now the norm in that field and sort of the reality of finance. And to a lesser extent, individual people have been exposed to all sorts of algorithms all the time. A spell checker in Word, for instance, is an algorithm. That being said, a lot of the algorithms we've been exposed to haven't really felt like something we might call AI, which of course is a somewhat nebulous term, but it hasn't reached that level of sort of surrealness where we're like, whoa, this feels like more than just a computer doing it. And that feeling, which is maybe a little bit more of a sort of emotional reaction than a really scientific distinction, but that feeling has been very, very widespread with ChatGPT. And so certainly we've seen a dramatic expansion of the public salience and the public interest in these issues, even if in some of these cases that their use isn't new. In some of the areas of government, that government normally regulates is not necessarily new, but you're certainly seeing a public reaction and then following that, a congressional reaction. And for instance, the general congressional legislators have become much, much more interested in this issue, I think. Not necessarily that they weren't before, but because the public salience has gone up so much, so has sort of the lawmaker interest as well, maybe unsurprisingly.
Well, it's definitely true that ChatGPT has highlighted and brought it really close to home what AI is capable of. And it's given a lot of people hope. It's given some of the others sort of consternation and hand-wringing, if not fear. But as you mentioned, we are still pretty far apart from EU in terms of collaboration. We don't even have some governance systems in place in the US, some of the basic sort of frameworks. So if technology is going so fast, I mean, Elon Musk is quoted as saying, oh, in 5 years, it's going to be, it's going to be smarter than humans in 5 years. So even if he is somewhat correct, we don't have a lot of time. So should we be putting a pause on things? Because policy always lags behind technology. Should we pause things? Is Italy right to say, look, we have a ban on ChatGPT, or should we prioritize? And if so, prioritize what?
Yeah, there's a fun now history of prognostications around AI progress. And the trend is overwhelmingly that they overestimate the speed of the progress. We're now 7 years out from Jeff Hinton saying that we should stop training radiologists because deep learning will replace radiology. And there was just a paper just came out very recently that said radiologists are still outperforming deep learning systems in breast cancer detection, which is like a very common, very data rich application that and this is also to say that there are more radiologists today than there were 7 years ago. In fact, there's a shortage because we have actually very high demand. It's really hard to get this type of prognostication right. Even if you are reading all the computer science literature, which I'm not entirely sure I think Elon Musk has the time to do. And why do I say this? I say this because really, if you look at the timeline for the progression of technology, it's much more gradual than it seems, especially if sort of ChatGPT has just entered your entered sort of your experience, which it has for a lot of people. So this feels very, very quick. Language models that these are based on really started coming out in 2016, 17. The underlying neural network developments that were really started to see them being successful started in 2012. The actual technology, the sort of algorithms itself that powered all these changes, even earlier than that, 10, 15 years before that, at least. In fact, they were invented technically in the 1950s. So if you really look sort of zoom out and look at the path, it's not as obvious that we're in a huge, enormous rush. And I say this as someone actively arguing for more AI regulation and protections on a near daily basis. So I do think we need more protections. I do think there is a somewhat urgency for the government to adapt. That being said, the pause letter, the idea that these things are going to advance so quickly, that they're super intelligent, and thus that horrible things will happen in terms of losing control over the path of humanity or losing all of our jobs or mass scale disinformation. Those claims are not really rooted either in a realistic understanding of the timeline of the technology, nor are they based in a lot of evidence around those specific problems, right? They're not demonstrating which jobs are going to get replaced. They're not saying, here's how all the disinformation is going to suddenly spread everywhere. So I find myself pretty skeptical. I just wish the letter had been a little more concrete, had pointed to a little more evidence. And, you know, that's how government should work. They move a little bit slowly, but in response to well-demonstrated problems.
Yeah, I think that there's an important distinction to be made between the actual power and possible implications of the large language model systems versus what is artificial intelligence, right? Because although you feel you can have a conversation with ChatGPT, it is just calculating language, right? I mean, literally doing the math on the words and what order to put them in and how to organize a paragraph, as opposed to anything that really is approaching intelligence. I was looking back to see how the Psyche project is doing, started by Doug Lennett in 84, I think, which was an attempt originally at the University of Texas to truly teach a system about the world, right? And build conceptual knowledge about the world. And yeah, like decades of work going into that. And I don't think it could hold a conversation with ChatGPT, but arguably might be closer to something that is on track to be an intelligence, at least as we understand it. So I don't know. I don't know if the legislation should be focused more on these things are certain, you know, they're faking us out, right? They're capable of producing deep fakes or whatever, as opposed to sort of the implications of large-scale calculations, which is really where most of this was going when it was focused on are people being discriminated against in, you know, mortgage applications and job interviews.
One part of this that's actually kind of handy is a lot of the government interventions that you might want to see if you're worried about these near-term problems, like we've mentioned, discrimination in hiring or lack of understanding of financial decisions made about you, surveillance in the workplace that seems really intrusive and you don't understand how it's evaluating you. If you wanted to expand near-term regulation and civil society protections, you would do things like update law to make sure it covers those examples. You would make sure federal agencies are staffed and have a good understanding of technology. You would make sure that Congress and the White House have experts and have funding to study these things, right, and have infrastructure. You would fund public research to make sure that we understand the different paths the technology can take and how it can better serve societal goals. Those are also things that kind of help if you're worried about the long-term path as well. A lot of the short-term interventions are going to be really powerful in terms of determining the long-term democratic governance of AI systems. They're not a full pause, but it's also not clear what a pause would do necessarily on its own.
Because we've been so successful with those in technology.
Yeah. And worth noting, you'd have to get a global pause, right? It doesn't only help if you do it just in the US and UK and Canada and the EU. There are other countries that are going to pursue these technologies, whether we do or not. And I worry that we would lose autonomy in some of the future direction of these systems. So it's not my preferred solution. I think it hasn't, the argument for it hasn't been super well demonstrated evidence. And if you are really worried about the long term, well, a lot of the short term interventions should look pretty good to you.
When you mentioned pause, I immediately thought about China, because if we were to pause, China isn't going to pause there. And in fact, they want to be the leader in AI. They've said that quite concretely.
Yep, so, by 2030.
Yeah. So, I mean, how China is focusing their AI application, you know, on things like facial recognition, state surveillance. So how does, number one, if we were to collaborate with each other, let's say UK, US, EU, the allies, how might that turn the tide against China? And what kind of challenges does China pose anyway, regardless of whether we collaborate or not?
I have a slightly unorthodox view on this, which is that I don't think most AI policy should be about China. In fact, I think the vast majority of it shouldn't be. By that, I mean, we should be using and regulating these countries mostly for our own benefit and really be narrowly focused on ourselves. We just don't have that much control over what China is going to do. There are some exceptions to that. I think some people in the national security space would disagree, and they have good reasons to do so. But on a day-to-day basis, things like what should we fund? We should fund things that are going to advance responsible commercial development and advanced science here in the US. We should build regulations that work to enable trade and provide strong civil society protections that let us trade and engage with the EU and Canada and the UK. And that has advantages of that system will be appealing to other countries that aren't really sure who, you know, where their alliances lay and where their in which direction they should develop trade relationships. So there are advantages to that that go sort of beyond our borders. But most of the time, AI policy should be sort of internally focused. There's a few exceptions to that. If you do really want to prevent or some authoritarian use of AI, or maybe help civil society activists and journalists in other countries, there's a few technologies I think that we do actually fund that are really about helping people abroad. You can see examples in that from the Open Tech Fund, which is funded technologies like Tor for anonymous web browsing, or Signal for encrypted messaging, or Lantern, which is peer-to-peer internet, which is being commonly used in Russia right now to enable internet access out, you know, from people inside the country to get to the open internet. These are actually all technologies invested in by the US federal government. And you can imagine versions of that for AI. For instance, we could be funding data poisoning for facial recognition. This is the kind of system you might use to sort of add some static, so add some noise to your own photos before you upload them, which makes it much harder to use those photos to identify your face. Maybe sort of useful in the US for commercial, you know, avoiding commercial facial detection, but certainly very valuable for individuals abroad living in autocratic states. So most of the time, I tend to think, let's look inward, make policies that make sense for ourselves. And in a few areas, maybe we can be helping out internationally. But overly focusing on China is, I think, sometimes to the detriment of good public policy. It's just not that much we can do, unfortunately. Now, I think people who are really invested in the semiconductors export controls would say those are going to be really effective. A little bit outside my expertise, so I'll leave it there.
What about disinformation? I mean, China, Russia, we are the recipient of a lot of state-sponsored disinformation campaigns that could really be spun up by AI. They could become so much better. Leslie mentioned deep fakes. Deep fakes are already becoming almost undiscernible from real. So in your view, if we're looking and focusing on ourselves and trying to aid perhaps other countries with applications such as Signal or Torch, what can we do, if we take that approach, what can we do about disinformation campaigns that are impacting our democracy, our way of life in a very real way today?
It's a good question. So far, we've been talking about kind of mostly about one of the two uses, major uses of AI, which is sort of the legitimate commercial use. That was the ones in finance and hiring and education and what to do about those. There is a whole different set of use cases here, which is, as you were saying, just malicious actors, right? People actively trying to identify cybersecurity vulnerabilities, for instance, with large language models, or to massively create mis and disinformation. On one hand, I still want to stick a little bit to my earlier argument that this is a more incremental change than most people realize. The language models are getting better, but they're not brand new. They've been around at least for 6-7 years. There are lots of other technologies that have made automating mis and disinformation easier, even things like headless browsers that let you automate your engagement with a website, right? And walk through the path of signing up for fake accounts easier. We don't talk about banning those, but they're also really important for, you know, creating bot armies for disinformation. That being said, you're right. Especially for non-native English speakers, there's a real concern that this is making it much easier to make authoritative, convincing sounding English text, say by Chinese or Russian actors. And I think that's probably true. I think that's probably legitimate, and it doesn't change how they distribute misinformation, but it makes it easier to write convincing misinformation, right? So it doesn't suddenly mean it reaches a million people. You still need to create lots of armies of fake bots. You still need to coordinate those and have them retweet, you know, content. That takes a lot of time, but it's getting a little easier to automate the content creation part. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone has a great answer to that. I will just add to your concerns and note that this is also happening when some major platforms are laying off a lot of their platform integrity and safety teams. We're seeing many people at Twitter, many people at Facebook getting laid off, whose core jobs were detecting and preventing a lot of this mis and disinformation.
So you're saying that if Elon was really that worried about this, then he shouldn't be laying those people off?
Oh, yeah. No, that was a deeply, completely hypocritical thing to do on its face. Yes, that is
surprise.
Yeah. That's a pretty easy claim to back up.
So we focus a lot on sort of trying to put fences around this stuff, or, you know, what are the implications? Is it getting ahead of us or not? But I mean, we also in the intro, Alexa also mentioned innovation. Are there things that we should be doing to support responsible innovation and advancing, whether it's, you know, seeing where this goes or making sure that it's available not just to the exclusive few megalopolies that are playing with it?
Yeah, for sure. So, and there's definitely some early evidence that large language models are going to help with workplace efficiency. This stuff's really early, but there was just a paper that came out, I think it may have came out today, showing that if you give new employees access to a generative chatbot that has been trained on past call center employees, that they're more productive as when they're new, right? So they're new to the job. They don't necessarily know what to say or what resources to use. And a chatbot that's sort of mimicking the more experienced employees can be really helpful. And they found that increased worker productivity in these in a Filipino call centers, which is the Philippines is like an enormous number of call centers and call center employees, that it increased their productivity by 14%, which is actually a pretty big number when you think about a relatively cheap model that you may only have to, you know, lease once or train once. Other examples, I think the developments in code generation have been quite significant, especially for relatively novice programmers who are still learning. There's a lot of sort of impressive early results for helping a programmer code a little bit faster. Again, I probably suspect it's on the range of 10 or 20%, right? Which is not of the time spent coding, probably not productivity overall. But that's useful. That's like a meaningful amount of productivity. Other examples, they're going to build it into Duolingo and it'll give you better feedback on your language learning as you're trying to figure out what part of your German sentence you got wrong, right? All of this is to say the productivity gains will be real. I think it's not clear that they're revolutionary, but they're pretty significant is maybe vaguely my phrasing at the moment. And we're certainly already doing a lot to support that. There's been billions in new science funding for AI. There's a new applied directorate of the National Science Foundation, which is supposed to do technology that's more immediately useful for like commercial uses, right? So less science for the sake of science and more science for the sake of commercial benefit. We're pouring money into semiconductor infrastructure. And I think the National AI Research Resource is another example. It's called the NAIR, which would advance public research into very large language models. Another example, currently unfunded, but the Biden administration is going to ask for $2.6 billion to fund that. That's the kind of thing that we're doing to support this ecosystem. I would say that's largely in the mold of what the US government normally does: infrastructure, research, sort of building an environment that's pro-innovation in general. And that is honestly usually easier to agree on than new regulatory steps. And often we see it come faster.
We've seen with social media companies, this lack of any kind of guardrails or policy or even regulation has meant that we are now dealing with massive disinformation campaigns, with people actually believing things that have been debunked over and over and over again. It has divided society. So I'm not going too much further into that, but the point is that sometimes history can be a teacher. So in this case, we don't have right now any concrete guardrails or mechanisms, certainly not one that we can rely on across national borders with our allies. And a lot of these companies are profit motivated. They are there to make money. And so the incentive for them is to return shareholder value and make money. So is one way to address this, could it be to talk about AI ethics? UNESCO just published something in April, guideline for AI ethics. And if we do that, in other words, if various frameworks of AI ethics, some of which have very fundamentally, some of the things are common across all of them, need for transparency, inclusion, accountability, et cetera. Is that a real reasonable stopgap measure to mitigate the risk about what if we're wrong? What if the technology does really advance so much faster than we can even try to capture it?
The AI ethics movement has in some ways been so successful that it's a little nauseating to hear about it almost, if that makes sense. Like, I think it's a lot of people have become frustrated with the AI ethics sort of talking points. Now, I think the reason that there's some frustration is because everyone has heard it, right? It's because it became very, very common for companies to release an AI ethics statement, to have a AI ethics board. Every NGO, INGO, international coalition of countries puts out some kind of AI ethics statement or framework. And because of that, I think there's a broad awareness of at least people working in the space or working in relevant spaces that there are a set of principles around AI that align with some sort of ethical values, like you mentioned, transparency and accuracy, safety, non-discrimination, maybe explainability, some sense of human appeal, or at least the ability to correct basic errors. Broadly, that'll get you to most of your ethics lists, right? And so it's valuable that we all kind of know that. At the same time, we haven't traditionally executed on governance of incredibly important things just by politely setting a bunch of norms. So I do expect some degree of more binding regulation in most countries, right? The fact that we agree on the norms doesn't mean then we say, well, now that we've agreed, everyone will follow them and we don't have to worry about bad actors. It probably means that if you are working at a company and you were already motivated to do the right thing, that you might have some more institutional buy-in, right? That other people at your company might support you, that there are more tools available to go use. There are more books about interpretable machine learning and papers about non-discrimination. And that's valuable. It saves you time if you can go use those tools to sort of implement AI ethics. So I do think there are real, very tangible, valuable things that came out of kind of that movement. And that's, say, 5 or 7 years of conversation. I don't expect it to solve these problems on their own. I don't expect it to course correct the behavior of bad actors. I do expect a significant role of law. We could talk about lots of examples, but certainly computational propagandists purporting large, you know, AI-driven disinformation campaigns are not particularly interested in our AI ethics statements, and we may need an intervention there that looks, and that, for the record, that's what the Digital Services Act is in the EU. That has a non-trivial mechanism for requiring large online platforms to do significantly more around disinformation. And what's interesting is because a lot of those companies are currently firing some of these teams, one has to wonder if Europe is going to actually maintain some of its protections, because now it's written down, hey, if you don't do this, we're going to fine you quite a bit of money. And not a lot of other people have that. So it's possible Europe maintains some of that kind of anti-disinformation efforts by the companies while other countries lose it. But it's a little too soon to tell if that's the case, but that's my suspicion.
So what I hear you saying in all of this is that it's time to walk in an orderly fashion to the indicated doors and don't rush or stampede, you know, that just do the sensible thing and we'll, you know, carry on. But what just sort of by way of going out statement, what would you say was success 5 years from now for AI, its involvement in our society and the responsible regulation around it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say first and foremost for the US, I would say there's like three broad pillars. One, which is passing federal data privacy. Don't forget that all of this is built on data. We still don't have a federal data privacy regime. And the incentives of AI drive dramatic increases in data collection and in surveillance. The story of Clearview AI is if you go get every face of every person on the internet, you'll be rich. Currently, that is also the story of ChatGPT and GPT-4, is that if you collect massive amount of data, by the way, GPT-4 in that paper release OpenAI did not mention where that data came from. They were incredibly close-lipped about the sourcing of that data, which is how, going back to the intro, or at least part of the story probably behind Italy saying, hey, we don't think this passes muster, because they do have GDPR, European data protection law. This is to say that currently, not only do we not have protections, but AI drives more invasive surveillance and stronger surveillance incentives from businesses and from states as well, from autocratic states. So data privacy, certainly one. The second, just because we were just talking about it, a large, you know, general regime for online platforms and online services. We basically don't regulate the internet at all in a lot of these areas. And I think at this point, it's clear that most of social media, a lot of search, a lot of online videos and online marketplaces have not gone exactly as we would have liked them to from a societal perspective. Now, that's a tricky area, and it's probably very optimistic to want regulation there in 5 years, but having some legal regime that gives, you know, creates some democratic governance over the online space. That doesn't necessarily sound like AI policy, but all of these things have really non-trivial algorithms built into them. The recommender systems on social media websites, the search algorithms, which now, by the way, are large language models often, or significantly composed of large language models, in, you know, Google search and other search engines, and soon potentially the generative AI systems that are built into them. That's definitely the second. And both of these things aren't really AI specific. They're kind of AI in the context of AI. The third is a little more AI specific. This is making sure all of the things we have historically regulated still apply when people use algorithms. That's making sure that we do appropriately deal with AI hiring or AI workplace surveillance, or AI financial services and AI underwriting, or AI to decide who gets insurance and who doesn't, AI medical provisioning. Collectively, most of the really important socioeconomic decisions about your life are being made by an algorithm, and it's really important that the existing civil society protections still apply. That's the third category, and I think that's probably not a totally new legal regime. That is a broad adaptation, something like a more sectorally specific issue by issue adaptation, but kind of gets overall the effect of the EU AI Act. And I would say those are the three, I think, primary goals for me. I think those are the three things that are most pressing as a society. I do think encouraging research about the societal impact of large models, making sure we're carefully tracking into the effects of algorithms on things like jobs and wages, which actually is often a bigger deal. There's actually a lot of jobs in this country, but wages are often what automation depresses. Making sure we're tracking that and thinking of policy interventions there too is also also really important. But I would say that those three are my core goals.
Well, it certainly sounds like they're very worthy goals, and I look forward to seeing them actually play out. It'll be a lot of work, but thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Alex. This was wonderful.
I'm happy to do it.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email Texsequences at texsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. Texsequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.